This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today, tourism is front and center at the annual spring marketing meeting at the Hawaii Convention Center. Does HTA need more or less marketing money? And how best can we manage the industry? We recently sat down with Representative Richard Onishi, the House Transportation Chairman, was in the audience at a recent forum where we talked about how much tourism is too much. He shared his ideas about what needs to change to better manage our record numbers and reduce the negative impacts to those who live here in the islands. In particular, the issue of enforcement of illegal short-term rentals are a sensitive spot.
We have House Bill 419, which provides funding to the counties for enforcement of their short-term vacation rental ordinances. So this is the second year that we've put this bill in. It didn't pass last year. We're hoping to get this passed. So if a county, for example, for any county, if they have in place a regulatory regime for short-term vacation rentals, permitting process, complaint process, enforcement process, you know, those kinds of separate taxing, property taxing scheme, we're willing to provide them up to $1 million for enforcement of those ordinances. The counties have not come in and lobbied for that process. Maui, Kauai, Hawaii County, Hawaii County, now that they passed their Bill 108, they all have in place ordinances. The city and county, they don't have one. And it's interesting, although they mentioned it, they didn't focus on asking people, hey, talk to your council people. Why haven't they passed ordinances to address short-term vacation rentals? We also have HB 908, which provides funds, $1 million, matching with private funds for homelessness in hotel and resort areas. This bill was the genesis of HLTA and HTA working together to try to address homelessness. And the private sector is willing, has been in the past, funding projects, and the state is now out of the TAT. We're looking to supplement that in order to expand that. One of the key projects that they've done is the repatriation of people who are homeless with their families or other loved ones back where they originally came from. Because the homeless issue for those people are not the fact that some other state gave them money to come to Hawaii. They probably came to Hawaii with the promise of a job or, any kind of expectation that they'd be able to make a living in Hawaii, and that fell through. And so now they don't have a way to go back, or, you know, in some cases they may be too embarrassed to go back. So what the program does is it contacts family, puts them in touch. If they're willing to take the homeless people back and help them, then this program pays for half of the costs, and the families pay for the other half, and they go back home. The success rate is in the 90% plus. We also have another bill, HB 548, which will provide additional funds to help with state parks, trails, infrastructure that for our natural resources. We currently allocate $3 million to DLNR for this purpose. What we found is there's not much accountability on how the funds are spent. So we added funds, understanding that there is greater impact, and we're going to move it into the HTA's natural resource program that they already have established, as well as their cultural program. So this is not so much for the cultural programs, but for the natural resource management programs that they do. They award grants to nonprofits and government entities in order to address our natural resource overuse. One of the key projects that HTA is trying to initiate is an ambassadors program, which will marry volunteers or hired staff with heavily used natural resource locations, trails, parks, etc., to help to explain to the visitors the significance of the area, help us protect it, you know, be good stewards of the land. So we're trying to get that established with the DLNR.
Well, there was that thought of, do we need a tourism czar, somebody who can help actually effectuate some of that change and coordination and efficiency?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that idea?
Last year, we put out a bill that would provide a fund that could be used for tourism impact. It could be any government entity that has identified a project that will address the issue of tourism impact. Lanikai, which was brought up, would be a prime example in terms of the city saying that they don't have enough funds to do traffic management or parking, etc. So this would have been a way that they could tap this fund to do a project that would address that impact. But that bill also didn't pass. So we are looking at those kinds of things. Now, the TAT allocation to the counties, the $103 million, that is really supposed to be used for tourism impact by the counties. So it's not like we're not trying to help the counties address tourism impact, but we have no accountability on how those monies are being spent. So we're not sure how they're spending it. You know, is it more police in Waikiki? Is it, helping to manage the county parks, you know, that are heavily used by tourists? We're not sure how these monies are being used. I would agree that there's not enough coordination and information. Even the counties can't specifically tell us what their needs are.
And getting back to the idea of money and the Hawaii Tourism Authority, so you're of the mind that they don't need more marketing money.
There's a lot of discussion about getting higher-end tourists, people who are willing to spend more. Part of the whole short-term accommodations issue is really because of tourists wanting to save money on a trip to Hawaii. Part of the whole spend issue is they're trying to experience local experiences, which means they're not going to Roy's for dinner. They're going to Rainbow Drive-In.
Right.
You know? So they're spending less, and it makes their vacation more affordable.
So there's some place for that.
Are we saying we don't want those people? How do you market Hawaii that does not make it look great for everybody, regardless of how much they spend?
But getting back to HTA's budget.
Well, I think HTA currently, out of the $79 million that they currently receive, I think about two-thirds of the funds are spent towards marketing efforts. I don't see really that we need to put in a lot more money into marketing. I think, though, it's like if we start to not market Hawaii and there's a downturn in tourism, how do we ramp that back up? You know, we saw that on the Big Island.
Right. And to some extent, yeah, there are some external forces that we have no control over. It's a natural disaster or a war or some kind of contagious disease that freaks everybody out. Or maybe we should have some kind of rapid response team within HTA. I don't know.
You know, we have sufficient lift coming in. Southwest, they're going to be starting to sell tickets. We are at the near tipping point. So we are looking at how do we try to move some volume to the neighbor islands instead of just Oahu.
That was House Transportation Chair and Big Island lawmaker Richard Onishi talking about managing tourism in the state as we are forecast to hit the record 10 million mark this year. We'll have more on HTA's spring marketing campaign on HPR News later today.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Compassion and Choices, working to improve end-of-life care, including medical aid in dying, now an option for terminally ill adults. CompassionandChoices.org/Hawaii.
I'm Bert Lum. Today on Bite Marks Cafe, as we approach crossover in the legislative session, there are several bills to keep an eye on. We'll talk to Transform Hawaii Government and learn about the bills to advance government data, establish a chief data officer, and commit to an IT strategic plan. That's today at 6:30 p.m. on Bite Marks Cafe.
This is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. For today's quiz, we'll be taking a cruise on a very winding Maui highway, the Hana Belt Road. Properly known as the Road to Hana, it is 68 miles long and connects the once isolated communities of East Maui with the rest of the island. Now, before 1925, being able to drive from Kahului to Hana was just a dream. If you wanted to get there, you took a boat or you went overland by horse or mule on a very long, very rough trail. But by June of 1925, after about 11 miles of the road to Hana had been completed, Governor Wallace Farrington declared the road officially opened. He led a grand procession of cars as far as it went, but it still wasn't open to the public until 1926. In fact, the road wasn't even completed until 1940, after President Roosevelt created the Hana Coast Civilian Conservation Corps as part of his Great Depression Jobs Program. Now, we've yet to mention an important detail of this road's creation. Who were the laborers who first put in sweat equity on the construction project? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people that you got it right.
Aloha, I'm George Cordero from the ACLU of Hawaii. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Over the years, we've seen great strides made to save endangered or threatened species here in the Hawaiian Islands. Today, we share the story of the plight of a bird known as the Micronesian kingfisher. The calls you're about to hear were recorded back in 1978. Now, our story today is about how zoos in places like Philadelphia and Arkansas and Missouri have been quietly working to save this species from disappearing altogether. Megan Lout, who's with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service here, just returned from the island of Guam, where planning is underway to reestablish a population of the stately bird known as the Micronesian kingfisher back into the wild. Its island home has been overrun with an invasive species, the brown tree snake, but recent efforts to minimize the threat have led us to this point where scientists are seriously considering re-releasing the kingfisher back into its native forest. Its numbers have gone from about two dozen to more than 130 in captivity.
It is a charismatic-looking bird. The males are bright blue and have a cinnamon-colored head, and they have a long bill. They're a predatory animal. If people are familiar with kingfishers on the mainland or kookaburras, they look like that. They're kind of a stout bird, and they have a really raucous call. They're little tough guys, and they're what we call sit-and-wait predators, so they'll sit on a branch and wait for a skink or a gecko to run by and then fly down and scoop it up and either fly back up onto the branch and smack it a few times and then swallow it whole.
So very patient predator.
Yes, they're patient predators.
Tell us about your first experience with the Micronesian kingfisher.
First time I saw sihek is the word in Chamorro, the name in Chamorro, 7 years ago or so. And I got to see them at the Guam Department of Aquatic and Wildlife Resources rearing facility. They're really a sight to see.
They're no longer found in the wild, correct?
That's right. They were brought into captivity over 30 years ago because people and biologists were noticing declines in all of Guam's forest bird species. And lucky for us and lucky for the kingfishers, the number of biologists had the foresight to bring in the last remaining kingfishers.
I remember being in St. Louis, and there was an op-ed, and the director of the St. Louis Zoo wrote in and said, "What I have at my zoo is more valuable than a Stradivarius." And he went on to describe the Micronesian kingfisher, and I was just so blown away. And he was inviting people to come down and see this incredible creature and you know, the efforts that they were going to save it, really.
Yeah, it is a charismatic species, and it is a challenge to maintain them in captivity. And so that is, yet again, one of the reasons we want to get them back in the wild, is that they'll thrive.
And so how do you actually release them back into the wild? Will they be released just to Guam, or will you release them to other islands in Micronesia?
We are evaluating all of our options right now. Ultimately, and technically, as far as the Fish and Wildlife Service is concerned, recovery is on Guam, but in order to recover them, we are going to explore all of our options.
People often think of Guam and the challenges they have with the brown tree snake. So how do we protect this kingfisher from the brown tree snake?
They've been able to control the numbers of them in areas, and so I think the timing of our, you know, our planning is really synchronous with the improvements in the ability to manage brown tree snakes. So we wouldn't be throwing them out into areas that are full of brown tree snakes. We would obviously be looking for safe areas.
What about releasing the Micronesian kingfisher, let's say, on one of the other islands, though, like Saipan or Tinian or one of the remote islands?
We are evaluating a full suite of options. We're in the beginning of the planning process, so we're looking at what is potentially available to us.
Is there anything that we can learn from our efforts here in Hawaii, you know, because we are the invasive species, you know, capital, right? We have the most endangered species here in Hawaii.
Well, we could look at, say, the alala and the fact that 20 years ago we didn't know what we were going, what the plan was for alala. And we also learned a lot of things about what it takes to have a release program and the challenges that are associated with that. And we'll apply all of those lessons and others from around the world. We're going to do the best for the bird that we can. And so we will take all the lessons that have been learned and the successes that we've had here in Hawaii, obviously our motivation, you know, for us to realize that this is something that we can do. Started with, I want to say, 16 birds. And so we've come a long way. Or they've come a long way.
Okay. All right. Anything else that we can do as a community to help support the program?
We'll keep everybody up to date on where we are. And we do want public involvement in this. It's a really exciting process and just so rewarding, too.
And what about funding?
Funding is always a challenge. So, of course, that's something that we're wrapping into our planning process. And we have, you know, some ideas of potential sources of funding, but it's something that, you know, as we work through, we'll be identifying and obviously applying for grants, doing the best that we can.
So how is it that you're able to get all these zoos to do what they're doing now? Was there a pot of money somewhere that you're able to, you know, use as seed money?
No, thankfully, the zoos have been funding this all on their own for the past 30 years.
Wow.
Yeah, so we're grateful to them for that, eternally grateful to them for that.
Wow, that is pretty terrific. Oh, that's amazing. But yeah, too bad we can't get like a GoFundMe kind of a thing going.
Yeah, well, when the time comes, I think this idea and this species are exciting, and that we will be able to get people, you know, just really excited about this idea.
All right. Well, great. Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Megan Laut, Recovery Coordinator for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, about the Micronesian kingfisher.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra. Superhero Soundtrack features the themes from The Avengers, Batman, The Incredibles, and more 7:30 p.m. this Friday at the Blaisdell. Tickets at hisymphony.org.
Gut and replace. It's a practice that lawmakers have come under scrutiny for. Today on a reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat, we learned that the controversial practice is now linked to our most controversial municipal project, rail. Marcel Henri on the line. Good morning, Marcel.
Morning, Catherine. Good to be here.
Yeah, now this story had me scratching my head because for the past several years, all we've heard about is we need an audit. We need an audit. And now we're not going to audit? Explain that.
Well, yeah, it's, you know, there's some kind of peculiarities here. It's the devil's in the details. This pertains to a measure that would repeal a requirement for future annual audits. So in other words, this doesn't really apply to the very large, widely anticipated series of audits that we're seeing coming out right now from the state auditor's office. Instead, What is moving through the legislature right now is a repeal for audits where the state auditor would review invoices and assess that other state officials are actually reviewing those invoices. Okay, kind of another step to review and to make sure that everything is on the up and up.
Right, but I know that there's even the latest call by our newest council member, right, for a forensic audit. But this one you're saying is a little bit different.
Yeah, this would be a routine annual audit by the state auditor's office that would look at the work being done by the Department of Accounting and General Services. Now, it goes back to 2017 when the state legislature bailed out the rail project again with a $2.5 billion package. And they really wanted to make sure they wanted to add in some extra steps for scrutiny. So they made sure that Accounting and General Services would before HART would just get reimbursed for its expenses, the state would take a look and make sure that those invoices were legit. And then secondarily, at the end of every year, the state auditor would look over DAG's head, Accounting and General Services head, and make sure that they are running this okay. So it was all these extra steps and levers that are in place. And basically what this all comes down to is the state legislature is trying to remove that requirement for that annual audit. What's kind of interesting to this and certainly caught my eye is they're trying to get out of the federal investigators away. Now that this project is under a federal probe or related to a federal probe, the state basically wants to make sure they don't interfere with that. That was part of the reasoning here.
Okay, so that's why we have this gut and replace thing as opposed to a separate bill onto its own modifying the law.
Yeah, well, why they use gut and replace is kind of its own thing there too. Yeah, that's always been a controversial thing. It's opposed by groups that are looking for more transparency in the legislative process, you know, where these changes don't happen last minute and don't really give the public a lot of advance warning to come in and testify either way.
And we had mentioned the council members' call for a forensic audit. No, that one, that looks for criminality, right?
Yeah, so this is something that's happening across the street on Punch Bowl at Honolulu Hale. You know, in the past, those efforts to spur on a forensic audit at Honolulu Hale, that hasn't really gone anywhere. But it's looking like they might indeed pass a resolution for a forensic audit. And that is a separate type of audit that does look for some kind of fraud or malfeasance or really criminal activity. You know, I talked to Les Kondo, who's the state auditor, last week, and he mentioned, yeah, we didn't find any potential criminality in our recent probe of rail. But the thing that he stressed was we weren't looking for it. Mm. So this kind of an audit that, you know, that's being push now would look for that kind of activity. You know, the key point is it could be expensive as well. You're looking at maybe about $2 million to conduct a forensic audit. So you're looking to, you know, keep costs in check, but you're also going to have to pay some money to do that.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll have to see what else Les Kondo's audit uncovers and see what the federal probe comes up with as well. But thanks a lot, yep. Marcel.
Sure thing. Thanks, Catherine.
That was Marcel Henry with our reality check from Honolulu Civil Beat. To read his full story, visit civilbeat.org. While much of the world is turning inward, six nations in East Africa are expanding international cooperation. They've created a group called the East African Community, whose goal is to deepen the political, economic, and judicial ties of its members. Emmanuel Ojira Shibuja is the president of the East African Court of Justice. Now, the court's job is to interpret the treaty that created the East African Community and settle disputes among other member nations. Now, Justice Ojira Shibuja is in town as the Richardson School of Law's first ever international jurist in residence from Africa. He sat down with Hawaii Public Radio's Ryan Finnerty to discuss how courts like his can be a force for peace and stability around the world.
The East African Community as it is now today is a community of which you could call a regional bloc, composed of six countries. That will be Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, Rwanda, Burundi, and South Sudan. And the current state of East African Community came about as a result of a treaty which was signed in 1997 among the three members of the community. That was Kenya. Those are the original founders of the community, Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania. Later on, Rwanda and Burundi acceded to the treaty establishing the East African Community. That was in 2007. And in 2016, South Sudan joined, and it's the sixth member and the youngest member of the East African Community.
So it's similar to the European Union, which is something Americans might be more familiar with.
Very similar to the European Union. It is an economic bloc. Maybe the slight difference is that the ultimate goal of the East African Community is for the countries which are members of the community to ultimately form a political federation.
And you're a justice on the East African Court of Justice,
yes,
which is the judicial arm of that union. And can you tell us a little bit about what you do in that role?
Yes. I'm the president of the East African Court of Justice. And as a president, my role is to sit as a judge. I have one vote as every judge in the East African Court. But I also preside over the judicial activities of the court. And I'm the president when we sit in the court.
Here in the United States, our courts, particularly our Supreme Court, has become very politicized in recent years, and there's a concern that it could lose the faith of the public because it has become so political. What is the relationship between the courts and the public like in East Africa?
Well, it's a new court. It's 18 years old. The visibility is not that much, so it's difficult to gauge what the feel of the public is vis-a-vis this court. But so far, I think we don't have any serious divide in the court in terms of political affiliation. And I don't think there's any political divide when it comes to interpreting the treaty.
What do you view as the role of international courts? So you work on a regional court with specific members, but there are international courts like the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice. Mm. What do you view as the role of those judicial bodies? And then also, what do you think are the consequences of a country like the United States really refusing to participate in those courts in many ways?
Well, all these courts, the International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court, all of them come for a given purpose. And the reason is there are certain cases which cannot be handled domestically because they transcend the borders. So whatever you cannot handle domestically, especially when it comes to international relations, the second best way to do it is to have an international court to adjudicate on those matters which cannot be adjudicated domestically. That's why certain courts are established, such as the International Criminal Court of Justice, the International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court. It's for those purposes that I've just highlighted. I do think that these courts should be supported and encouraged because they tend to adjudicate on cases which could otherwise go unadjudicated, and this would create a lot of instability in the world if we don't have a judicial arm to deal with these cases. So my hope is that the United States will continue supporting these courts.
In the United States and in parts of Europe, there has been a retreat from internationalism in many ways and a return to nationalism. And in your part of the world, in East Africa, it seems to be going in the opposite direction. And there is these partner nations are moving towards more integration. Why do you think that is?
Well, I do believe it's because we do see benefits of this integration. You would argue that in other parts of the world, such as Europe, there are some countries which are components of the European Union, which are strong as individual countries. But in Africa, and I'm talking about East Africa at this point in time, we only have one country which is a developing country. The rest of the countries are considered to be least developed. And they do need each other in terms of trade, free movement of labor, free movement of goods, in order to have any chance. I mean, a country such as Rwanda, where I come from originally, is, in terms of land mass, smaller than Hawaii. So you do need other bigger countries in order to trade, in order to have goods coming from those countries. So this is why I think at the moment everyone believes that a community such as East Africa would make individual components of that community stronger together rather than apart.
You mentioned that you're from the nation of Rwanda, which in America most people will associate with the genocide from 25, 30 years ago.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about what happened? I know you've studied the Rwandan genocide extensively. What happened from that point to now that's led to this transformation? And maybe what can the rest of the world learn about preventing a similar event from happening?
Yes. First of all, I would want to bring it to your light that the title that is used for the genocide is the genocide against the Tutsis in Rwanda, as opposed to the Rwandan genocide. And the reason why it's termed as the genocide against the Tutsis is because you have to go back to the definition of genocide. The definition of genocide is that it has to be aimed at exterminating a given group of people. And that's why it's proper to call it according to the group that it was targeted at. So it's called the genocide against the Tutsis. There are so many reasons to learn from the genocide against the Tutsis in Rwanda, and also the aftermath of how you deal with how a society can deal with the consequences of having violence which culminates into a genocide. And the first lesson that you can learn is genocide is not a one-off. It's a process. It starts with certain elements such as discrimination of a given group, dehumanizing a given group, to the extent that it leads to killing a group of certain people because you don't consider them to be humans. They're actually around about 9 stages towards genocide. So the first thing that you have to learn is certain elements such as discrimination of any group could culminate into a genocide if not taken care of as early as you can. Dehumanizing of a given group could end up having a given group being exterminated later on because they are not considered to be humans. It's much more easier to exterminate a group if you don't consider them to be humans. So that is the first lesson. Deal with any sign of certain elements such as discrimination, which can ultimately end up being a genocide, as early as you can. That's number one. The second lesson that you can learn from the genocide in Rwanda is however much you descend into violence, there is a possibility of coming out of that violence as long as you include people and have proper governance structures as Rwanda has today, and also have structures which allow for unity and reconciliation and create space for the community to always dialogue before you reach that space where you engage in violence. It's better to dialogue on most of the issues touching the community. So if you create this space where individuals can always engage in constant dialogue, I think this is another lesson that we've learned from Rwanda, that you have to create that if you really want to have a sustained way of living in a peaceful and harmonious way.
What role do you think that projects like the East African Community, what role do those play in preventing similar tragedies?
I think they will play a major role in future. And even today, I believe we can still play that role given the mandate of the court. And the reason I'm saying so is when you look at the governing principles of most communities, including the East African community, they do envisage certain important principles as the foundational basis for these communities. That's the rule of law, good governance, democracy, respect of human rights. So if these cases can be adjudicated to a judicial arm of any community, then I do believe that this is one way of dealing with disputes before they escalate into being a genocide. So as long as you have an independent arm of communities such as the East African Court of Justice, then this is another forum of dealing with disputes.
Well, Mr. Justice, thank you so much for joining us today and welcome to Hawaii.
Thank you so much, and I look forward to my stay here in Hawaii, and I've learned one or two words, mahalo.
That was Emmanuel Ojira Shibuja, president of the East African Court of Justice. He'll be giving a public talk tomorrow at 11:45 on the Manoa campus. We'll have the details and a longer version of the interview posted with this story at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from Haleakala Waldorf School on Maui and Honolulu Waldorf School on Oahu, serving Hawaii's families from infancy with parent-child programs through high school, now accepting applications at both schools.
earlier in the show, we were taking a cruise down memory lane, actually the road to Hana, or what was originally called the Belt Road, because it connected the isolated communities of Maui and wraps around the coast. Now, many laborers worked on the road between 1923 and 1940. But did you know about the workmen who started the project? Well, between 1923 and 25, the first 11 miles were hacked, hoed, blasted, and scraped out of Haleakala's coastal cliffs and jungles by convict construction crews. In 1926, Kainai Prison Camp was built to house the inmates of the road crew. But in 1934, it was converted into quarters for the Civilian Conservation Corps, created by FDR. Now, the Corps finished the job in 6 years, and ever since 1940, locals and visitors alike have been able to drive the long, winding road to Heavenly Hana. And congratulations to our winner, Paul James Brown from Maui. He's a tour guide who shares the history of the Hana Belt Road with his visitors, so he got it right. And that's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If you haven't heard of the Honolulu Biennial, well, here's what you need to know. It's an arts festival that has its roots in Europe, and apparently it's taken off here on the islands in a big way. HBR's Noe Tanigawa is here to tell us all about it. Morning.
Yeah, good morning, Catherine. It's fun thinking about this biennial because they're getting big all around the world. They're proliferating. There are about 100 going on around the world right now. And the whole idea behind it is to activate the entire city with art. Okay, the most famous one is the Venice Biennale. It started in 1895, and it was kind of like a world's fair where you just get the art out there, and then we make these other things. And all these countries were touting their artists and trying to outdo each other every year for kind of like, global cultural leadership, right? In 21st century terms, though, a Biennale is the way a city says, we are part of the creative economy. I mean, like in Venice for right now, there are 50 national pavilions, and those pavilions are sponsored by their governments, by trade and innovation businesses. So everybody is trying to get on this as a big, opportunity to get in front of people, because really successful biennials draw hundreds of thousands of people for a set period of time. Artworks overflow museums. They go into eateries and public spaces. There are panels, films. There are all kinds of parallel exhibitions. And that's what's starting to happen this year with the second Honolulu Biennial. And the whole thing becomes this immersive art experience in your town.
So how long does it run?
It's going to go March 8th to May 5th. It starts this Friday. And, we're going to be in 10 different locations here. I mean, yesterday I stopped by the old famous footwear spot there at Ward Center. If you'll remember, that's where the hub is this time. And that's kind of the center for this Honolulu Biennial HB19, Honolulu Biennial 2019. So let's get in there with the curator, okay? Her name is Nina Tonga. She's an art historian. She specializes in Pacific art, and she's a curator of the Pacific art at the Museum of New Zealand, Te Papa Tongarewa. Now, the Honolulu Biennial focuses on art made all around the Pacific, and the theme this year is to make wrong right now. Here's HB19 curator Nina Tonga on how she approaches this art.
My belief around art, I believe art is for everyone. The young, the old, the trained, those that are in another field, I think you all bring something unique to looking at something that is meant to inspire or challenge or encourage. What I hope is just being open to the experiences, to look at the work the way that you do, but to also consider the sites. We've been really careful about thinking where we want people to visit again.
They've chosen 10 places around Honolulu that are going to be activated by art for the next 2 months. We're talking about the Honolulu Museum of Art, Bishop Museum, McCoy Pavilion, right? How's that? Also, Ali'iolani Hale, the judicial building behind the Kamehameha statue, Hawaii State Art Museum, Foster Botanical Garden, John Young Museum, the Richard Street YWCA Laniakea, and various spots through Chinatown as the couple of months go by. I talked with Catherine Tweeter also. She's the executive director and co-founder of the Biennial. And we met at the Hub yesterday, and there was all this sawing, certain amount of painting going on, but there was really a lot of dealing with wires and projections and electronics. I mean, 20 artists are going to put their pieces there at the Hub in one location. It's a great place to start. And Tweeter says that if you're a creative, you can jump in on it too.
Hey, we've got this stage space. Come on over. Like, you can have the stage for free and use it for performance, anything that you'd like. And so we don't charge anyone from the creative community to use it. We're trying to respond to this deep need in our community for a creative space. So we still have some open slots for that.
You've got some organized school tour things, right?
We do, yeah. So we have over 2,200 kids signed up for our school tours. We provide free transportation as well to Foster Botanical Garden and a new downtown loop. So Hawaii State Art Museum, YWCA Laniakea, and Ali'i'i Lanihale. So they get to go see all three of those art exhibits.
You know, you had some really great docents last time. You can't possibly have docents the whole time everywhere, can you?
We do.
Look at all the locations this time.
We do. We have docents. We have incredible adult and keiki docents. We have over 30 keiki docents signed up.
I'm telling you, Catherine, kids love this stuff because they basically know as much about it as anybody else. You know what I mean?
Well, no, I have to ask, though, what about neighbor island artists?
They are represented in this exhibition. There are, I think, 30 or so, maybe more, Hawaii artists represented. And nearly that many, if not more, international artists also in town from all over the Pacific Rim countries.
But is there a chance, though, for this biennial to be hosted on one of the neighbor islands?
You know, that's a goal. But let me tell you, this is HB19. It's Honolulu Biennial number 2. The exponential growth since the last time, since 2017, is amazing. Come on, Honolulu. Come on, neighbor islands. Come to Honolulu for this event. It's the next 2 months. You're going to have an opportunity to see some amazing stuff. And if you've got to start somewhere, go to the Hub. Okay, Friday, it's going to be there with a fashion show, all kinds of immersive stuff going on. And I got to tell you, too, that Foster Garden's another great place. Last year, there was like what looked like a 2-ton rock positioned over one of the pathways. And there were some terrific Yayoi Kusama had some pink polka dot like ladybugs all over in the grasses.
Nice.
So you can join in, and remember there are guided tours that you can find out about online for how to make your own tour up. So I don't know, start at the Hub this Friday or start at the Hub any day.
Okay, but and as far as the art being available for purchase?
Sure, available for purchase. You know, but primarily this is there to enjoy. And what I really love, too, is they have a super commitment to the next generation of art appreciators here because they maxed out on their school tours. So they've created a sort of keiki workbook, and you can call their very terrific education supervisor there, Hannah, who can help you use the workbook to design your own school or family tour through the whole thing.
Is there any way for any of the neighbor island artists to be kind of compensated because they've got to bring their stuff over?
I'm not sure how they were compensated for that or how it was paid. You know, artists
we'll have to check into that.
Yeah, artists from everywhere are used to paying a lot of their own way.
Okay, all right. Thanks so much, Noe. That was Noe Tanigawa talking about Biennial 2019. Find your stories online at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Coming up on the next On Point, 6 million Americans rely on insulin to survive. Many can no longer afford it. What happens when big pharma, big profits, and strong patent laws lead to dying patients? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 2.
on the next Fresh Air, director Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck, who made the Oscar-winning The Lives of Others. His latest film, Never Look Away, is about an artist who grows up in Germany when Nazis ban modern art, comes of age in East Germany when communists force artists to paint propaganda, and flees to West Germany where anything goes. Join us.
This afternoon at 3.
That's it for today. Up tomorrow, well, lawmakers said no to legalizing marijuana for recreational use this session, though efforts are continuing to soften the sanctions for possession of the drug. Tell us what you think. Call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.